guardian.co.uk.
Have you always wanted to write a novel, a history, a short story, your epitaph? Want to know how successful authors do it? It's all in a new Guardian book. I'll tell you more at the end of this podcast.
Welcome to the Guardian Book Club. I'm Claire Armistead, books editor of The Guardian and Observer. We're here this month to listen to Ian M. Banks talk about the third of his culture novels, The Use of Weapons, just as his latest in the series is being published. That's The Hydrogen Sonata. Ian first came to our book club in his literary rather than science fiction role, though he might challenge that definition. He came as plain Ian Banks to talk about The Wasp Factory. But it was when writing that book that Ian M. Banks first formed the ideas that went on to make the basis of the culture, as he told John Mullen.
The original draft of The Wasp Factory was written in, I think it was 1974. And it was the first of the culture novels. It was a novel that kind of gave birth to the culture in a sense, because I wanted to write about this fabulously capable martial character. Not brilliant in terms of, you know, wielding, you know, fists or, you know, heaving a cutlass or guns or anything else, but just a military tactician and strategist as well. But I wanted to be working for the good guys, and therefore I had to come up with, like, who the hell would be the good guys who had some morally, you know, plausible reason for employing someone like Zarqawi. And the culture kind of coalesced around this very idea. And it was kind of, I'd read so much science fiction, especially at the time, American science fiction, which seemed to have almost the monopoly on the energy. British SF seemed to have a monopoly on the well-written stuff, but it was generally really miserabilist, you know. The American stuff was, you know, can do, you know. It was politically naive, and it was certainly, you know, economically stupid, frankly. But you know, it was interesting, and it had an energy. So I wanted to address all that stuff, and I'd read so much SF of both, you know, American and British flavours, as it were. And I wanted to do something that's kind of a coalescence, as it were, of the two. And that all sorts of ideas were floating around, and they just clumped together. The idea behind Zarqawi was kind of the little bit of grit that, you know, I'm kind of big upping it here, just saying it's a girl, but you know what I mean? That's what caused the culture to come into being. But my initial idea, I was trying to be really clever back then. I was a mere 20 years old, so I'd gone beyond the peak of wisdom, which I believe comes about 17 and a half years of age, but I was convinced I knew absolutely everything. And I'd gone beyond that, and I thought, right, I want to write something that is a very, very clever and structuralist. I'd had the misfortune to encounter the word structuralism at university. Completely misunderstood what the hell it actually meant, but I decided in very, very, very firm terms what it ought to mean, certainly to me, and so I produced this structure for the book, and it involved an X and a Y axis. And amongst these were things like flight as freedom and imprisonment and so on. There's all these different categories, and the book starts with the first intersection, then it goes to the first and the first again, and the second and the second, and the next iteration, the third and the third, as well as the others, and so on, into the heart of the novel, and then they gradually decrease back up again. So there's more and more complexity, and then less and less, in a very visual, formal sort of sense to get to the end of the novel. Sadly, this meant that the surprise ending to the novel had to occur right in the middle of it, so that the entire second half of what was already a very, very long novel was in complete and utter anticlimax. And at the time, in a formal sense, it had elegance.
Yeah.
It was beautiful. It was a fabulous thing to behold. In sketch form, you know, reading it was a fucking pain in the ass. Frankly, you know. Also, I was still at a stage where why use one adjective when six would do? You know, so full of proper prose. So I kind of abandoned it years before. And it was Ken McLeod, my good pal Ken McLeod, who I'd known since sort of high school in Greenock. We were both living in London at the time, and Ken said, "I'm going to try and attempt to do Ken McLeod's accent." He said, "I think there's a good novel in there trying to get out." Ken is from the islands originally, and so I said, "I think you're mad." But I gave the manuscript to him, and he came back. He said, "I think what you, I'll stop doing the accent. I think what you ought to do is do what the main, you know, sort of story of the book forward in time and the backstory backwards in time."
So that was his. It's not, it not was that was
not
his
my
idea.
Idea. Sadly, I know. Oh, it gets worse, you know. But anyway, so he said, "Why not do that and try and differentiate between the two of them?" And I can't remember if it was him or me that came up with the idea of doing Roman numerals backwards, whatever. Conventional, you know, Arabic numerals forward, and that way he said you'll get to the end of both bits where they should be, Ian, at the end. I told him he was mad again, and I said, "But I'll go and try it." So I did. I thought, okay, you're right, damn it.
Yeah.
And the whole thing about the, you know, surprise ending of the book, I was quite happily telling. Using the authorial voice to call the central character by the name that he wants to be called all the way through the book. And my brilliant editor, James Hale, who was not really used to science fiction, didn't really, you know, get science fiction entirely, but he knew story, he knew a novel. He said, "Well, you can't do that. That's cheating. The authorial voice, everybody else can call the central character by the name he wants, but not the authorial voice in the novel. If you're going to do it that way, you just can't. It's cheating. It's not fair." So I told him that he was mad as well, and then went away, chastened, and tried it, and it worked as well. So
yeah,
there's one bit. Funny because
those two things come together. I mean, when I first read the novel, I didn't know. Nobody told me that it had this backwards narrative it took me a little while to kind of realise what was happening. I mean, I realised that kind of there were two stories here, but it took me a little while to realise, you know, it took me a chapter or two to realise one was going backwards. And it's a very disorientating, the thing that your editorial guy advised, which I'm sure is good advice, I would be reading it. I think I read, I would read the first Roman numeral chapter 13 in Roman numerals, and it would be, he did this, he did that. Is this the same character? He's refusing to tell me. It's so irritating. He's playing with me. He's mucking me about. But actually, and it took me a long time. It was quite a sort of ask for the reader, especially when the book first came out and they weren't all being told, "Yeah, there's this really clever thing, you'll enjoy this." They were just being left to their own devices. It's quite a big ask of the reader to take that disorientation as being a kind of promise of things to come rather than a sort of a bit of a kind of mucking them around.
Oh, yeah, I think you would have struggled to justify that to a publisher or anybody else as a first novel, or even a first novel within a series, as it were. I think given that, you know, Fleabits had come before it and Player of Games, so you had two culture novels before that, and you could then say, this is another culture novel, whatever. And I think that kind of did make a difference. I think I'm getting the sequence right, yeah. I think that made a difference because it fitted into a...
Because you'd already got the trust of readers.
Kind of, yes. Yeah. But I mean, I took your point about what you said at the start of your first piece about it, that in some ways, if it wasn't a science fiction novel, it would be gradually quite radically literary.
Yeah, no, if it wasn't a science fiction novel, if it was a sort of... if it wasn't a science fiction novel, it would be called a very literary novel, and there would be reviewers saying, "Oh, he's trying to get on the Booker shortlist by playing all these clever games." You know, we've had novels with reverse chronologies. Martin Amis has done that. Sarah Waters has done that. You know, Don DeLillo's done that. But now he's not just doing reverse chronology; he's doing alternate reverse and forward chronology. My God, what a... You know, what a show-off he is.
Yeah, I know. But actually, it was Ken MacLeod, all the time.
Yeah.
I think, to be fair, though, it was science fiction writers that did that whole thing, the backwards thing first.
Do you think that your readers, or maybe science fiction readers, actually are more willing to kind of accommodate that sort of trickery?
Oh, definitely, yeah. I mean, it's relatively unusual, but it's not completely unknown. I think if you're a science fiction reader, you're used to... you're used to being, in a sense, part of an outside kind of culture. You're used to being, in a subculture or whatever. And you you're willing to be a bit more understanding about the experiments that writers might take. I think particularly when you think that there is some sort of point to it in a way.
Yeah.
I think that one of the main criticisms that a lot of us have about what you might call very self-conscious literary experimentation, it seems to be done for its own sake or just to prove that you are dead clever, you yourself personally the writer. I wouldn't entirely step away from that myself. But I mean, I occasionally I do things just to show I can, just for a laugh, you know. But that's just pride, really. And showing off, I think, is a technical term. My mother would have used. But I think you have a slightly more open mind if you're an SF reader. Actually, I think a lot more open mind in a way. I think you're not so sort of you're not so constrained by literary categories.
Also, the choice of the episodes. Why? What were you thinking of?
It's kind of the formative experiences in Dekalwe's life. I mean,
being decapitated as well.
I love the idea that when you're decapitated, you're not really decapitated, you're bebodied. You are inside your head. I mean, obviously, the central nervous system and the body, embodiment thing has a reason and a function, but basically, you're never decapitated, you're bebodied. It's your body that you lose. So I love that, but also, I remember feeling a lovely warm glow of satisfaction when I realised, to take you back a bit, I read a thing in, was that The Guardian or The Observer, about people, I think it was back in the time of the Falklands War, people talking about being in combat, with soldiers talking about being in combat, and just how, horrible and ghastly, and all the stuff you never get to see on television, because it's all censored, just the ghastly injuries that happen to people. And someone was talking, he'd been interviewed or was writing a piece saying about, if you're standing next to someone who got hit by a big bullet, like a half inch, a 50 caliber bullet, whatever, round, and it hit them in their pelvis, and there was shrapnel from your buddy's pelvis that then just went off like a grenade and went into other people's bodies. And so the people standing around this guy who was hit with this round and had his pelvis shattered or whatever, they had bits of him inside them. I remember, and this is one of the, in a sense, the awful things about being a writer. You read that and you think, oh, that's horrible. Wait, well, I can use that.
I remember when I used to read quite a lot of sci-fi when I was younger, was the thing I liked about it, which was, I think, probably what they called in the 18th century, the sublime, the sense that there's this huge spaces and you could sort of, in your imagination, inhabit them. And you get that sense because of, in the reverse chronology chapters, sort of in each one, because they're little episodes, not in every one, but in most of them, you're off in some different world. Hmm.
It's a habitable place. It's kind of a bit like Earth, but there's something there which maybe means that it's not like Earth. That seemed quite an important part of the effect of a book where, at least to the reader who hasn't read all the rest of, I confess, not all the rest of the culture novels, this universe is at once thronged with worlds, but kind of the geography of it is very difficult to sort of get a map of, deliberately.
Oh, yeah, completely, yeah. I mean, the idea is that there's lots of places that are roughly like Earth. I mean, it's sort of addressed in a slightly lame way in a novel where, someone actually says, well, it's a bit like the Doctor Who problem. Doctor Who goes to all these different planets. And without even the use of the help of a Douglas Adams-style babelfish, everyone speaks English, Amazing, isn't it? Star Trek had the same thing. And so in a sense...
Yeah, I wanted to ask you, so everybody speaks kind of, not just English, but contemporary demotic
English.
And the drones all say, oh shit, and things like that, don't they?
What you have to imagine is actually a translation from the original culture, marine language original.
It's like the bits where Sir Walter Scott says, gazooks, and he says, by the way, this is just a transliteration of what in fact was Norman French, but I'm
precisely
not going to do that.
The thing about that, it's addressed in the sense that someone says, these are remarkably similar places you end up, doing your stuff, your military stuff in Zakawa, which is, well, these are the niches that I'm put within, because the culture is vast, the universe, the galaxy is vast, and these are the places that they choose to use me, and they will all have a certain similarity. Now, it's kind of skipping over the whole idea that there's such a plethora of, human or vaguely humanoid planet settlements, empires, whatever, in the first place. I mean, there is actually a reason for that, but I'm not telling anyone yet. But it's actually, in a sense, it's semi-plausible, because there's lots of other niches that you're simply ignoring, because that isn't what you'd put a character like Zakawi in the first place. And Zakawi actually himself, and he's talking to the poet Lassie that he falls in love with, says, well, it's a bit like alcohol. You know, look out into the dim and distant reaches of the galaxy, clouds of alcohol. And that's my case, you know.
As a novel reader, the culture, I mean, we can talk about what it means sort of in terms of kind of political allegory and things, but it's kind of quite a risky thing for fiction, because they're so bloody powerful. And that wouldn't be so bad if they were malign, because that would give you'd be fighting against them.
Yeah, really made bad guy.
But they are benevolent, essentially.
Oh, yeah.
And incredibly powerful. And, of course, the one thing that risks, you must know this, because it's sort of, I mean, the characters themselves even kind of talk about it, is that the characters, particularly the hero, lose their sense of agency and purpose and whatever, because it's actually, in some ways, it's all rigged. And in novels, I suppose, essentially, when it's rigged malignly, I don't know, Tessa of the D'Urbervilles, that's really, that's not risky. That's not risky. I mean, it may be depressing, it may be tragic, but it's not fictionally risky. But it's when it's rigged benignly, that's quite a risk, isn't it?
Don't turn my phone off, sorry. Excuse me, sorry. La-la-la-la-la. Yes, anyway, beg your pardon. Yes, I know what you mean. The danger is that you basically say the cultures are the good guys. Now, in a way, the way I got around that, in a sense, by the time we got to use of weapons, was that I really had approached it from the opposite angle, as it were. The first novel that was actually published, considered Phlebas, where the protagonist, a central character, who certainly at least at first you're completely meant to identify as a proper hero, totally hates the culture. On the, can't stand the culture. On the other side, fighting against it, and again, at least initially, has quite good lines about the people I'm fighting for on the side of life. The culture is against life. You're just all about your machines and so on. You know, I like that little knife myself. I don't know, I went to John Wayne mode for any good reason. But anyway, so I'd kind of, in a sense, I'd sort of already dealt with that before we got to. To use of weapons. So it was then, it wasn't, I didn't have to include the irony the opposite, the devil's advocate point of view I might have had to otherwise, because it had already been dealt with in the very first novel.
So you maybe you've built up some reader's faith in the culture, just as the protagonist seems to have faith in, because quite late in the novel, essentially, he's running this rather brilliant military campaign.
Oh, he's doing really well.
Where he's got this real losing load of common incompetence, and he's telling the war, and he's reversing the war. And inevitably, you're reading it, and you're and you're sort of it's almost impossible not to sort of be encouraging him from the sidelines. The supermodel model emissary of the culture says, actually,
sorry,
you're not supposed to do this.
Yeah, didn't think you're going to win here. So so he has to arrange to lose,
and he has to lose. But but also the reader has to kind of think that's even if they feel a bit thwarted in their sympathies, they have to feel that's fair, don't they? They have to think there must be a reason. There's a reason for this, and it makes fictional sense.
In the end, what the culture would say is that we know what we're doing here. We have done this so many times in the past. There are good statistical reasons for this is the way it has to play out. And it actually goes kind of wrong. It actually it runs out of control and it gets a lot more horrible than it's meant to. But the way that Zakawi kind of redeems himself, the way that it's meant to make it work in the context of the novel, is that he doesn't just then fuck off. He doesn't just say, one to beam up and that's him. He actually goes out and he he walks amongst them, and he comes very close to death himself. Yeah. And the only way he gets out of it in the end is that he spells out his own name and dead bodies on the perimeter wall. Yeah. That's how he attracts their attention and gets away again. There's actually an echo of that in a bit. Because the whole book is about some concentricity, and there's this whole thing about concentric times and so on. And there's a bit where he's trapped on this little island, and all sorts of horrible things have happened to him, and he's crawling around this little bit. And he's kind of going right back to the most formative experience of his life. And he's a child, and everything sort of first, in a sense, went wrong, whatever. And it's about, he imagined this little rock in a pool on an island in a little lake, on a bigger island and a bigger lake, on a continent. So, and I guess in this fevered state, it becomes this concentric image of the entire universe. You know, because beyond that greater continent is the ocean. Beyond the ocean is the planet. Beyond the planet is the source that particular solar system, and then beyond that, the galaxy and the universe. And so, this tremendous feeling of concentricity, and so that sort of feeds back into this feeling that he has at the time. And it also goes back to in theory, if this works properly in the book, if you take use of weapons and you precisely fold it back in the very, very middle, in theory, you get back to the very, very furthest back bit in time, back in the garden when all the children are there, when Elithymo and Zacalwe are all there, and Darkens and Nevueta. And if it works properly, and I might have got it out by a page or two, there's an image of one of them, I think it's Elithymo. What was it called? Anyway, whoever, sitting and got a handful of pebbles in one hand, and he's just throwing them as accurately as he can into precisely the same bit of water to produce these ripples. And this is the stone boat sort of thing, that image. And it's from there that everything starts to go wrong. Everything ripples out from that through the entire novel. And that was the last, that was the only surviving bit of structuralism that I managed to get into the book.
Let's throw it open, shall we? We've got some travelling mics. I hope you don't mind the little pauses while we... So there's a gentleman here, and then somebody right at the back there.
Dizzy Asmal, I'm fascinated. Why did you bring her back? I mean, I think she's a fantastic character. But part of what appeals to me about her is that she's been to Earth, and she's been to Paris and New York and Berlin. And why does she come back?
Yes, yeah, Asmal was there originally, yes, and use of weapons in a very, very early draft, in the 1974 draft, or whatever the hell it was. And then I just thought it'd be a giggle to bring her back for... I thought she might as well be the person who was on the starship Arbitrary when it encounters Earth in 1979 or whatever. 77. Whatever the hell it is, 77. I don't know why, I kind of liked her as a character. She was quite different in the original draft, from the way she is now. And obviously the later draft of Use of Weapons was kind of informed by the subsequent story that had happened in the meantime of State of the Art. And she was probably more alien, in a sense, in the original draft. And in fact, in the original draft, I had a big... when I first came out with Use of Weapons, the culture was going to call itself the Aliens. That was the two choices were the Aliens or the culture. And the culture thing basically came from, and I know that it wasn't from the Nazi I thought it was from, because I think, was it Goebbels was meant to have said, when I hear the word culture, I reach for my gun?
Goering.
Actually, but it turns out it wasn't actually him.
Really?
I read the relevant Clive James essay a couple of years ago, and apparently it wasn't him after all, it was some playwright, Austrian playwright or something. Anyway, but I just always liked that. I remember reading it and thinking, fuck you, you Nazi bastard. I thought, come with fucking culture then. But in a very mature kind of way. But the Aliens was the other idea, you know. So I think in that sense, Smile was always a bit more alien than she was before. But I just liked the idea of using her. I mean, I tend to shy away from using characters too often. Zacalwe has actually occurred. He's the very last word in a subsequent novel, many years later, which even at the time I thought, can I get away with this? But at a certain point, you just have to think, fuck it, yeah.
One of the characteristics of the world that Zacalwe, as we call him, comes from, and the various worlds that he interacts with as a military presence, seems to be that they have hierarchies and they have fighting over resources. Now, obviously, with the culture, then you have limitless resources. And so acquisitiveness is not seen or doesn't become a vice. Hmm. Is this a get out?
A get out? I don't say get out. I mean, simply, what it's trying to account for is the fact that although the culture is as, you know, self-sufficiently wonderful thing, it has to cope with other, other worlds, other empires, other hierarchies, whatever. That it's kind of stymied. It can't just go in and say, "Hello, we are incredibly wonderful and perfect, and now you will do things the way we want you to do." Can't really do that. That is a kind of imperialism. I'm on the side of anti-imperialists pretty much down the line. I don't believe in that, even in a kind of benign imperialism that the culture might represent. At the moment there's a real sort of drive in Britain to paint the British Empire as somehow benign. I think Nyaya or Yo Ferguson is largely behind this. It's fucking shite, quite frankly. You know, I talked to Kenyans about it. Yeah, thank you. Imperialism is basically a bad thing. Okay, yes, fair enough. There's always that bit about, what did the Romans ever do for us? Yeah. They also crucified you by the tens of thousands, but never mind. So I think you can't simply, because you are coming from this position of material or in a sense, even sort of moral superiority, just go in and tell people how to behave and simply force them to do what you want to do. All you can do, in a sense, is provide a good example. In a sense, that is mostly what the culture is trying to do. Now, having said that, it will use people as a calibre to interfere when it can, where it thinks there's a real sort of crux point, you know, a card where you can use a mercenary, basically, like Zakawi. But you can't just go in and just tell people how they have to live their lives.
Right at the back, please.
I love science fiction. You seem so keen on it. I wonder how much you feel you're treading water slightly with your non-M books. The transition was a bit M. Stonemouth is very pedestrian, I would say, even though I'm a big fan.
Ooh.
Sorry.
Good God, controversial. That's good. Controversial's good, yes.
Can you see yourself as ever just doing the science fiction and dropping the non-science fiction stuff?
After transition, you can kind of see that happening. Probably not. I mean, one of the things that lets me still be able to write a book a year is that each new book is different from the one what I wrote before. So being able to work in two genres, in a sense, it almost doesn't matter. In theory, it doesn't matter which genres they actually are. I could be writing, you know, detective fiction and mainstream, or detective fiction and science fiction, or, westerns or something. The fact that I can write in different genres means that I come to each book feeling, you know, refreshed, as it were. I'm not always writing the same sort of thing. Stonemouth, pedestrian, I don't know, I kind of saw it as just nice and, you know, a page-turner. And I hate to disappoint you, but my intention is to make the next mainstream one a bit like that as well. I'm going to dial up the weirdness a wee bit, I think, if I can. But I think I want another fairly, you know, not another transition, because it actually was. I maintain it's 51% mainstream, but it was actually published as science fiction in the States. It had an
more,
M in it.
More of that.
Yeah, well, yeah. I've come to be very... I watch my publishers carefully when I say something like... They say, "So, Ian, what's the next SF I'm going to be?" And I go, "It's a culture novel." And they go, "Really?" I say, "Well, it's a non-culture novel." And I go, and they go, "Oh, that's good as well." I exaggerate for comic effect, but, you know. As long as I keep on having ideas, it's what I would rather do into my dotage, and in a sense, I'd almost rather give up the mainstream, but I'd hate to give up either. It is the contrast between the two that gives me whatever energy I still have, that lets me, you know, always go to the next book feeling refreshed, as it were.
Do you have more fun with invention as Ian M. Banks, rather than the rather more literary and localised Ian Banks novels? And a second, the main question is all the invention in service of describing the culture or a character or something, or is some of it just fun?
It's mostly just fun, quite frankly. You know, if the emergent phenomenon of happening to flesh out the culture series also comes to pass, that's good. It's mostly just fun. And yeah, I kind of... No, I've tried to explain in the past, like, writing mainstream literature is like playing the piano right, piano, fabulous instrument, capable of great, unlike the kind of on-off binary thing that is the harpsichord, the piano is capable of enormous tactility and expression because you can hit hard, you can let go slowly and so on, all that sort of stuff. Science fiction is like having an organ. Not being rude here, no smut involved. I mean, an organ, but I mean, a big fuck-off organ. I mean, an organ the size to fill something like Liverpool Cathedral. Not the Catholic one, the big brick-built one, you know. A fucking enormous cathedral. You've got not one keyboard. No, that's not enough. Three, four, who cares, right? And a thing for your feet as well. So you go da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And you've got stops. What do you do with stops? Yes, yeah, pull them all out. You know, that is science fiction. Well, it's particularly space opera. It's what the fabulous Brian Alice described as widescreen baroque space opera. It's not capable of the same emotional subtlety as playing the piano. Because again, organs, again, they're kind of binary. You don't have the same touch, the same feel. They're not capable of the same emotional subtlety as the piano is. But by God, they can make you can turn your lungs into your ears. You know, you feel notes inside. You know. Especially with, you know, if you've got organ pipes you could crawl down, you know, that's a serious bass note, dude, you know what I'm saying, you know. So that is the difference, you know, and I kind of love, I'm off the leash with the science fiction, and particularly the culture. I can just let my imagination go where it damn well pleases. In some ways it is more rewarding to write in the mainstream because you're working within the constraints, things which, if you look at an equation, in science fiction, parts of the equation which are variables in mainstream become constants. You can't, you know, vary the things you could before. You can't vary human nature. You know what I mean? You can't include alien nature and so on. You can't change the laws of physics, Jim, that's for sure. So I'm off the leash with science fiction, yet there is more fun there. I just enjoy it more. Yeah, and I think sometimes it shows. Sometimes maybe a bit too much, you know. But yeah, I do. I enjoy it more. But the thing I enjoy most of all is, as I said before, writing within two different genres and basically getting away with it.
Well, with that musical analogy, which was that wonderful musical analogy, which makes the effort of any literary critic seem very feeble in comparison. You don't need your own critic.
No.
Yeah. I'm sorry. We need to stop it because. So thanks to you, and of course, above all, thanks to Ian.
Thank you so much.
Oh, they're dimming the lights.
Hi, I'm Simon Hattonstone. I'm a Guardian journalist, and I occasionally write books that are not read by many people. Let me tell you about some of the great advice from those who really know how to do it. Top name authors that you can read in a new Guardian book called Write. It's brilliant. Funny, perverse, bonkers and wise. If it sounds like writing, then I rewrite, says Elmore Leonard. There's Anne Enright for despairing writers. Remember, the first 12 years are the worst. So, don't put off that dream of winning the Booker Prize any longer. Get inspired by our new Guardian book, Write. You can get yours for half price, £6.50, using promo code PODCAST. To order, visit guardian.co.uk/bookshop. Anytime up to the end of October.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.